School of Fear by Douglas Shackleton. Chapter 1. How It Started. It started 3 years ago, more or less, on my third or fourth day in the secondary school. It was lunchtime, and I was standing in the playground, just looking around me. We used to live up north, but then my father changed his job and we moved down here, so everything was new for me. The town, the school, everything. I was a bit lost, I suppose. Anyway, I didn't know anybody in the playground. I still didn't know anybody's names, of course. In fact, when I look back, I can see I didn't know very much at all, but I was soon going to find out. Anyway, what happened that day was this. I saw Barry Cowan and his gang beat up Tommy Marcus. Tommy was a skinny little fellow, even skinnier and smaller than me. There are a lot of people in the playground, so I couldn't hear what they were saying to him. But I saw Cowan and his two mates slapping Tommy and pushing him and laughing at him. They were all older and bigger than him. He didn't have a chance. They were standing about 20 yards away, but even at that distance I could see that Tommy was close to tears. The funny thing is that nobody else noticed. As I said, the playground was full of other boys. Some were first years, like Tommy and me, but there were also a lot of older boys, like Cowan. But everybody was busy doing something else, especially looking the other way. Except me, that is. I was still too stupid to look the other way. Anyway, I saw Tommy put his hand into his pocket, take out some money and give it to Cowan. But just at that moment, Norman Taylor, one of Cowan's mates, turned round and saw me watching them. "Hey, you," he said. "What are you looking at?" "Nothing," I said. I'm not looking at anything." He walked up to me quickly. He was the smallest of the three of them, not much taller than me, in fact, but he frightened me just the same. He had thin lips and little black eyes, and he never smiled. He always looked angry and dangerous. The two others, Cowan and a fellow called Des Hogg, followed him. They stood around me the same way they were standing round Tommy Marcus a few minutes earlier. "So you're calling me a liar, are you?" asked Taylor. "No, really," I said. "I didn't see anything." "He really didn't see a thing," Taylor said to the others, mimicking my northern accent. They laughed. I looked around, but there wasn't anyone to help me. Even Tommy Marcus, I noticed, was disappearing into the main school building, only too happy that their attention had shifted to somebody else. "Hey, Goggles," Des Hogg asked, "your eyesight isn't very good, is it?" He called me Goggles because in those days I used to wear glasses. "No," I said, "it isn't." "That's lucky for you then," Taylor said. Suddenly, without warning, he pushed me in the chest. It was so unexpected that I almost fell down. "Go on then," he said, "shove off." The other two laughed again. I was starting to walk away from them when I heard Barry Cowan's voice for the first time. "Hey, you Goggles," he said, "come here. I want to talk to you." I stopped. My heart was beating hard. Cowan walked calmly up to me. He put his arm around my shoulder as if we were the best friends in the world. "Do you know what a grass is, Goggles?" he asked. I shook my head. "No, I didn't think so," he said. "Well, I'll tell you, shall I? A grass is somebody who grasses. That's what a grass is. A grass is somebody who can't keep his mouth shut, who tells tales. Do you know what I mean? A grass is the lowest form of life, Goggles, the very lowest form. Do you know what happens to grasses?" Again, I shook my head. "They get hurt," he said calmly. He slapped me gently on the cheek. "They get hurt very badly." Then he and the two others walked away, leaving me standing there in the middle of the playground. That was how it started. That was how they noticed me. That was how my life began to change. Chapter 2. A Year of Fear. After that, of course, I tried to avoid Cowan and his friends. But even in a relatively big school like ours, with more than 1,000 pupils, that's easier to say than to do. In the classrooms during lessons, I was relatively safe, but in the corridors, in the cloakroom, in the toilets, in the canteen, they could suddenly appear from nowhere. "Hey, Goggles, come here a minute, will you? We want to talk to you." Worst of all was the playground. There you had no chance of escaping them. I used to hate the sound of the lunch bell. I used to dread it. Other pupils couldn't wait for the classes to end, but not me. The bell meant I had to go outside. At first it was small things. They used to mimic my northern accent, especially when there were girls around. They said I spoke like that because I was gay. That was a big joke with them. Or they used to walk into me when I wasn't looking, deliberately, and then pretend it was an accident. "Oh, sorry, Goggles. Didn't see you there. Hope I didn't hurt you. Ha ha." One day I was standing in the queue in the canteen. I was holding a tray with a bowl of soup on it. Des Hogg suddenly appeared from nowhere and bumped into the tray, sending all the soup down the front of my trousers. That was another big joke. Everybody thought that was very funny. There was a teacher there too, Miss Twiddle, the music teacher. She saw everything that happened, but she didn't say anything. Just, "Stop fooling around there, you boys. And you, Henderson, go and get cleaned up immediately." At that time, nobody called me Henderson except the teachers. Everybody else called me Goggles. Anyway, to cut a long story short, I hated school. Every day it seemed there was something new. One day I was walking down the corridor when Norman Taylor, who was standing there with a group of girls, stuck out his leg and tripped me. As I was getting to my feet, he asked, "Have a nice trip, did you, Goggles?" One day Cowan broke my pen in half and then put it back in my breast pocket so that my white shirt was stained with blue ink. One rainy day, they threw my books out a second-floor window. When I found them in the teacher's car park below, they were soaking wet. Often I thought to myself that things couldn't get any worse, but every time I thought that, I found out I was wrong. Things could get worse, and they did. One day, near the end of the first year, I was in the toilets. I was just washing my hands, and I looked up. In the mirror, I saw the three of them standing behind me. Immediately, I knew I was in serious trouble. I turned round to face them. Barry Cowan reached up and took my glasses off and put them on the end of his own nose. Then, turning to his mates, he said, "How do I look, lads? More intellectual, don't you think? What do you think, Goggles? Come on, let's have your opinion. They look better on me than they do on you, don't they?" I didn't say anything. I knew something terrible was going to happen, but I had no idea how to stop it. "Well, perhaps not," he said. He took the glasses off and dropped them on the tiled floor. Then very calmly, he placed one foot over them and stepped down hard. I heard the sound of breaking glass, but before I could do anything, Cowan punched me hard in the stomach. I bent over, unable to breathe. He took me by the hair and lifted my head up. "Listen carefully, Goggles," Cowan said. "My friends and I have come to the conclusion that you need our help. You need us to protect you, Goggles, from vicious attacks like this one. I mean, look at you, Goggles. You're completely useless, aren't you? You can't defend yourself at all, can you?" I groaned with pain. "So, fortunately," he continued, "in future we'll be here to protect you. Of course, you understand. A service like this costs money, doesn't it? We'll expect the first payment next week. Understand?" He released me and I slipped to the floor. "Understand?" he repeated, pushing my chest gently with his foot. "Yes," I gasped. "Good," he said. "Oh, and just one more thing. You remember what I told you about grasses, don't you? So you be careful what you say to people, eh? Or you might get really hurt." Then the three of them walked away. I sat there on the floor for a while, trying to get my breath back. The toilets were empty now. At least, I thought they were. I started feeling about for my glasses. "Here," said a voice. I looked up. It was Tommy Marcus. he was handing me what remained of my glasses. Chapter 3. Useless. Barry Cowan was right about one thing. I was completely useless. I didn't have the least idea of what to do. Naturally, I couldn't tell my parents what was happening. For one thing, my father's a lorry driver. His attitude has always been, if somebody hits you, then you hit them back 3 times harder than they hit you. That was his way of solving problems, but somehow I didn't think it would work for me. As for my mother, well, my mother simply can't understand some situations. After the incident in the toilets, I thought to myself, if I tell her, she'll immediately go to the headmaster, or perhaps even to the police. Then what will everybody think of me? They'll know I grassed. When Barry Cowan finds out, he'll kill me. So I lied to them at home. I told them I was cleaning my glasses when they slipped out of my hand, and then I accidentally stepped on them. You have to learn to be more careful with your things, my mother said. You seem to think that money grows on trees. That night I couldn't sleep. For hours and hours I lay awake asking myself what I was going to do. Near midnight I heard my parents coming up the stairs and going to bed. After a while I heard my father snoring. I got out of bed and went quietly down the stairs in the dark. I found my father's jacket where he always leaves it, hanging over the back of a chair in the kitchen. His wallet was in the inside pocket. There was more than £20 in it. I took 4, then put the wallet back where it was before. That was the first time I stole from my parents, but it wasn't the last. Every week I took a few pounds from my father's pockets or from my mother's purse. I gave all of it to Barry Cowan. He didn't even say anything when he saw me coming. He just held out his hand. I felt scared and guilty all the time. I couldn't sleep because I was worrying so much. I knew it was only a question of time before my parents noticed their money was missing. Of course, I was useless at school as well. All the teachers thought I was stupid. But how could I concentrate on the geography of the European Union or the history of England in the reign of Henry VIII when I was living in a permanent state of fear? I sat at the back of the class and hoped that nobody would notice me. Then, finally, thank goodness, the summer holidays arrived and I was able to escape. That summer, like every summer, I spent 2 months on my uncle's farm up in the north of England. There's always plenty of work to do on a farm, but I never enjoyed it as much as I did that year. I was hundreds of miles away from Barry Cowan and his friends. They couldn't reach me here. It was wonderful. I almost forgot they existed. But as the weeks passed, of course, as July slipped into August, and then as August began to slip towards September, I began to think about them again. I knew I had to go back. My mother met me at the station. "Oh, look how you've grown," she said. "You're almost as tall as me now." It was funny she said that, because I didn't feel any taller. Certainly I didn't feel any bigger when I met Cowan and his friends the next day. It was still 3 or 4 days before school was due to start again, and I wasn't expecting to meet them at all. Anyway, it happened like this. My mother gave me £25 to buy myself a new pair of trousers, because my old ones were too small now. So I took the bus into the town centre. When I came out of the bus station, my heart sank. There, about 20 yards away, in front of me, leaning against a wall, smoking and laughing, were Cowan and Hogg and Taylor. For a moment I thought, quick, go back inside, they haven't seen you yet. But I couldn't move. My legs simply refused to move. "Well, well, well," I heard Cowan call out, "if it isn't our old pal Goggles." Anyway, to cut a long story short, they took the money, of course. They even took my bus fare, so I had to walk the 3 miles back home. And of course I had to lie to my parents. "I don't know what happened to the money. I lost it somewhere." I could see they didn't believe me. My father kept saying, "Come on, son. What really happened? What did you do with the money your mum gave you?" "I told you," I shouted. "I told you. I don't know what happened. I lost it, that's all." Then I ran up the stairs to my bedroom. Later, when my mother said that tea was ready, I told her I wasn't hungry. I didn't want anything. It was true, too. I lay on the bed feeling awful, guilty, not knowing what to do. I knew that in a few days it was all going to start again, just like before, only worse. I thought about running away from home. But where to? I thought about jumping in front of a train. But I knew I didn't have the guts. Yes, Barry Cowan was right. I was absolutely useless. Chapter 4. The Grass. For the new school year, Cowan and his friends had a new word. Now they weren't collecting protection money anymore. Now they were taxing me. But the result was the same. And if I couldn't get money, I had to find something else to give them instead. My CD collection, for example, my Walkman, my Reebok trainers, anything, everything. All year was like that. It was even worse than before. Being pushed and shoved, slapped and tripped, laughed at, humiliated, alone and afraid all the time. And stealing, lying, feeling ashamed of myself, while trying to make myself invisible, and never, never succeeding. Tommy Marcus wasn't in the same class as me, but sometimes I passed him in a corridor or saw him waiting at the bus stop. We didn't speak to each other much, I don't know why, but I could tell from the way he looked at me that he was going through the same hell as I was. He looked like a dog that somebody beats and mistreats all the time, until in the end it's scared that everybody who comes near is going to kick it. Tommy had that look in his eye, the look of a beaten dog. I suppose I had it too, for the same reason. For both of us, school was a never-ending punishment. Sometimes I heard people say, "Your school days are the best days of your life." I felt like saying, "Not for me, they're not. Not for Tommy Marcus, not for people like us." Even more than the other kids, we lived for the holidays. 2 weeks at Christmas, 2 weeks at Easter, then the long summer holidays. Of course, when the holidays finally came, we spent most of them worrying about what was going to happen when they ended. And then they did end, and the punishment started all over again. I thought it would go on forever. But then, near the end of my third year, when I was 14, something happened. One day, somebody threw a school bag full of books out of a second floor window. Unfortunately for her, Miss Twiddle, the music teacher, was standing in the car park down below. The bag hit her on the head and knocked her unconscious. They had to call an ambulance to take her to the hospital. Later, the police came to the school and started asking questions. Of course, nobody knew anything. Nobody had seen or heard anything. One policewoman came into our class. She was young, with blonde hair, but she looked very serious and tough. I still remember one or two of the things she said. "I know that some of you know who threw that bag," she said, "and I know that you're afraid to talk. On the one hand, you're afraid of the people who push you about and bully you, and on the other hand, you're afraid that if you speak up, your friends will think that you're a telltale, a grass. But believe me, you're not a grass because you defend yourself against people who are physically stronger than you. Sometimes it takes a lot of courage to stand up and speak out." I suppose she said the same thing in all the classes she went to. Anyway, at lunchtime, Tommy Marcus came up to me in the playground. "We both know who threw that bag out of the window," he said. "Why don't we go to the police and tell them everything?" "No way, Tommy," I said. "No way. Don't even think about it. You don't want to be a grass, do you?" He looked at me as if he couldn't understand what I was saying, as if I was speaking Chinese or something. "A grass is the lowest form of life," I continued. "Don't do it, Tommy." But Tommy did it anyway. He went to the headmaster's office and told them everything. I suppose he mentioned my name too, because they sent for me almost immediately. The headmaster's secretary came into the science class and told the teacher. "The headmaster would like to see William Henderson." When I went into the headmaster's office, the first person I saw was the policewoman who came to our class that morning. Tommy was there, and standing on the other side of the room were Barry Cowan, Des Hogg and Norman Taylor. On the head's desk were a lot of things taken from Cowan's locker, I suppose. There were 3 cell phones, my Walkman, a wallet, a lot of different pens, some money, things like that. The headmaster said, "Marcus has told us that some of these things belong to you, Henderson. He says that Cowan forced you to give them to him. Is that correct?" I didn't know what to say. I looked at Barry Cowan. To my surprise, he didn't seem afraid at all. In fact, he seemed to be enjoying himself. He had a big smile on his face. He said, "Goggles is my pal, aren't you, mate? He likes giving me things. It's not my fault if I'm popular." The headmaster looked sharply at Cowan, then at me again. "Well, Henderson," he asked, "is that true? Did you give him things freely, or did he force you to give him things?" I could see Cowan looking at me. He was almost laughing. "Yes, sir," I said, "it's true. I gave him a lot of things. He's my pal, you see." The head and the policewoman asked me the same questions again and again, but I refused to change my story. About 30 minutes later, they told Tommy and me that we could go. Standing in the corridor outside the head's office, I said to him, "Well, Tommy, you've done it now. You're a grass." "And you're a coward," he replied. Chapter 5. The Coward. Coward. That word hurt. For months I thought about it. My mind returned to it constantly, the way one's tongue returns to an aching tooth. It hurt because I knew it was true. But in the end, my lies didn't help Barry Cowan at all. It turned out that Miss Twiddle was seriously injured when the bag hit her. I heard something about her skull being cracked when she fell on the ground. So Cowan and Des Hogg had to go to juvenile court. The judge gave them 6 months at a sort of prison for young people, a special correction centre. I never saw either of them again. For some strange reason, Norman Taylor was allowed to stay on at the school, but he seemed completely lost without his 2 friends. There were still 2 or 3 weeks to go before the summer holidays, but he didn't give me any more trouble. When I met him in the playground or passed him in a corridor, he pretended not to see me. Several interesting things happened that summer, which I spent, as usual, on my uncle's farm up north. The first thing was that between the end of June and the beginning of September, I grew 15 inches taller, so that by the end of the summer I was nearly as tall as my father. Also, since I was working in the fields all day and eating like a horse, I developed a lot of muscles on my arms and chest. I got another good piece of news too. One day I went to the optician's to have my eyes tested and was told that I didn't have to wear glasses any longer, so nobody could call me Goggles anymore. The result of all these changes was that when I met somebody who hadn't seen me for a while, even relatives, they actually didn't recognise me. Everybody was amazed to see how tall and strong I was. And now that I didn't have to worry about Barry Cowan anymore, I was almost looking forward to starting school again. Well, that's an exaggeration, of course, but what I mean is I didn't have to be afraid of anyone. But the funniest thing of all was this. When school did start again, I noticed that people were treating me differently. When I met Norman Taylor, I could see how surprised he was by my appearance. His mouth fell open. He just didn't know what to say. Finally, he managed to get out a few words. Hello, Bill. Nice to see you. How are you doing?" It was the first time he ever called me by my name. After that, we became quite good friends. Well, sort of friends. He used to follow me around everywhere I went. And the truth is, I didn't really have any other friends. Anyway, I remember something that happened during the first week. One morning, Norman and me were leaning against the school gates, watching the other pupils arrive. "This is where you and Cowan and Hogg used to stand," I reminded him. "Oh, really? Yeah, I suppose it is," he said, looking at his shoes. Just then, a car stopped in front of us, an expensive-looking car. A skinny little boy wearing thick glasses got out. The woman driving was obviously his mother. I heard her saying, "Have a nice day, darling. I'll pick you up at 3:30. Then she drove off. The boy stood there for a few minutes, looking round, as if he wasn't sure what to do next. "Hey, Bill," Norman Taylor said, "let's have a little fun, eh?" He called out to the small, thin boy. "Hey, you, goggles." The boy looked at him with his eyes wide open like a frightened rabbit. "Yeah, you," Norman Taylor said. "Come here a minute. We want to talk to you." In that instant, I had that funny feeling you get sometimes when you think you've already been in a place and lived the same experience already. "Leave him alone," I said. I was surprised by the anger in my voice. "What?" Norman Taylor said, moving quickly away from me as if he thought I was going to hit him. "Leave the boy alone," I said again, more quietly this time. "Stay away from him, do you hear?" "Oh, all right, Bill," Norman Taylor said. "There's no need to get upset. It was just an idea, that's all, just an idea." "A bad idea," I said, looking him in the eye. "Right, okay, Bill. Anything you say, mate." A few minutes later, the school bell rang, and we went to our classes.